It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Trump administration says it will provide partial payments for federal food assistance this month. Here in Wisconsin, about 700,000 people rely on the food share program to buy groceries. The decision comes after two federal judges ruled that freezing payments for SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as Food Share in Wisconsin, is unlawful. And on Friday, Governor Evers declared a state of emergency focused on how the government shutdown is impacting food assistance. To get a closer look at food insecurity in Wisconsin and what low-income families are faced with, we have Hetty Brown, executive director of Cooley CAP. It's a community action agency serving Crawford, La Crosse, Monroe, and Vernon counties. Hetty, welcome.
Thank you.
And Sarah Halpern-Meekin is here, director of the UW-Madison Institute for Research on Poverty and Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community in the School of Human Ecology. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, let's start with you. There are still unknowns about these partial payments, but what can you tell us about the Trump administration's response to these court orders and what they will mean for people who rely on food assistance in Wisconsin?
Just as you said, there are still a lot of unknowns. So it seems that the administration has indicated that they're going to comply with the order to use some of the contingency fund that was already allocated before the shutdown to pay benefits for November. The administration has indicated that those will not be full benefit payments. So exactly what that looks like, exactly what size of benefits households can be expected to receive, and the time frame that they'll receive them is still unknown.
Will it be complicated to process these partial payments in Wisconsin? Because from what I understand, states are going to have to figure this out, this partial payment.
Yes, states are going to have to figure this out. They're going to have to figure out the amount and how to distribute it. Doing that during the shutdown is even more complicated because many federal counterparts who they would otherwise be able to consult with are not on the job due to the government shutdown.
Hetty, your organization works on anti-poverty programs in Southwest Wisconsin. What do these SNAP benefits do for people facing hunger in your part of Wisconsin?
Well, SNAP, or what it's known as, is Food Share in Wisconsin, is a critical lifeline for working families, families with older adults, children, and people with disabilities in our service area and throughout the state. It's really important benefits, especially for families who can't afford the high cost of food otherwise. And during this pause that families are experiencing, they're just simply really concerned how they're going to fill the gap. While food pantries have truly stepped up and our community has stepped up, food pantries cannot fill the gap that is left by SNAP.
How has your community action agency responded in this moment? What are you doing differently?
Well, our food pantries, as well as all the food pantries throughout our region, have extended our services. We have worked closely together, as well as with community partners, to gather more food resources from the community. Our partners, retail partners, community groups, faith-based groups have responded by donating additional food. However, as said, you know, this cannot replace Food Share. And so we are eagerly awaiting the federal response and then the state's response to see how partial payments can be distributed quickly.
Well, let's hear from two people who are dealing with the lapse in food aid. First is Lillian Santiago of Milwaukee County. She has seven children, has used SNAP on and off, sometimes while working multiple jobs. Here's what she told WPR yesterday. Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have this clip. I want to also turn to Latricia Williams, a mother who relies on Food Share. And Latricia spoke to WPR at Kinship Community Food Center in Milwaukee late last month. And she said that her SNAP is running out. It's really getting difficult because she's a SNAP for her child's milk. And she went on to say, Sarah, that she has a four-month-old who relies on formula. Can you talk a little bit about what these families might be facing, especially if they have young children?
Yeah,
so
and it's
I think
Sarah, go ahead first, and then Hetty.
Thanks. I think it's important to distinguish between the WIC program, which is a nutrition program that supports people during pregnancy, postpartum while breastfeeding, and then children up to age 5. WIC is a program that families rely on heavily, especially during that period of the first year of a child's life when they are using formula. WIC has continued to be funded. So the federal government was able to find funding, and there was not that same immediate threat to the end of WIC benefits. SNAP benefits, however, are serving families, you know, not just with young children, and WIC benefits are much, much smaller. You know, we might be talking about the equivalent of $30, $40 worth of food a month in WIC. SNAP benefits are much larger and are what families are relying on most heavily to feed their children. You know, the average monthly benefit for a family of three, we're talking about something on the order of $6 per person per day. So it's not a huge amount of money, but it's also something that families absolutely have to have to take care of their kids. And in fact, we see in research that that families often run out of SNAP benefits toward the last week or so of the month. And when kids take tests in school during that time, they tend to do less well on them. In fact, when they've done research looking at kids who take college entrance exams, when their family has more SNAP benefits versus less, the kids do better on college entrance exams when they have more SNAP benefits, and they're more likely to go to college. So we know there are big impacts for families when they don't have enough money to get the food their children need.
Hetty, what comes up for you when you hear about the struggles of, you know, mothers and parents who have young children?
Yeah, and it's important to realize that the stressors that are on families right now in trying to feed their families, as Sarah pointed out, are on top of other financial pressures that they've been feeling all year. We have seen major increases over the last couple of years in rent prices, car insurance, heating and cooling costs. Our utility bills have increased, rates have increased year over year over year. So these are all the financial pressures that families are experiencing. Food prices are on top of that. And it's not just the food share program that is being paused. Heating assistance, the federal heating assistance program, has also not been funded through this shutdown. So while people are applying for their energy assistance, we are not able to make payments for their heating assistance, and families don't know when that's going to come through either. So people are really uncertain. They're struggling to understand when these programs are going to come through. They're starting to panic, and that is a word that my team is using to describe how people are showing up at our offices and our food pantries is the word panicked, and they don't know what's going to happen. People that can't pay their utility bills, can't pay their food bills, these are individuals that become unstable in their housing because then they can't pay their rent prices.
It's a compounding problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Sarah, yesterday, a lawmaker, I believe from Connecticut, told reporters he's living on $6.20 a day for food to try to draw attention to this issue. For people who have never relied on this form of assistance, what can be done to help people relate now in some way?
A lot of people really do rely on this benefit. You know, at any one time, 1 in 8 people, both in Wisconsin and the US, is using SNAP. And if we look at people's likelihood of having ever relied on food assistance over the course of their lives, it's a much larger proportion. So I think we don't want to treat this like it's, you know, a strange problem, this need for resources to ensure access to food is common. And we know it's common, you know, more so in some counties than others. We see a range, you know, in some counties in Wisconsin, we're talking about, you know, 1 in 6 people relying on SNAP. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. I think we also really take the benefits of SNAP for granted. Before the food stamp program was rolled out in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s, there were issues with starvation and malnutrition in the US. And so we don't see those problems now the same way. And I think we assume that those problems are gone. The reason we don't see them, though, is because we have programs in place that provide people access to food. So if we threaten that access, we raise the risk that some of those problems could return.
Do you feel this moment is a significant erosion of the social safety net?
It certainly is a moment where families are going to have challenges. And so we don't know how long this shutdown is going to continue. You know, this is an unprecedented length in recent history for a government shutdown. And if it continues on longer, it's really a question of what December would bring, for example.
Hetty, in our last few moments together, what do you tell people who are really scared right now, really worried about their payments?
We do the best we can to serve them. We are, you know, food pantries especially are places where people come not just for food, but for other connection to benefits, to services. And so we and all of the food pantries in our communities across Wisconsin are working to provide food, to provide security by connecting them with other resources in the community that they need.
And we're going to leave it there. Hetty Brown, Executive Director of Cooley CAP, and Sarah Halpern-Meakin, Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Coming up, suicide prevention trainings around the state aim for a goal of zero suicides in Wisconsin.
I can't tell you how many stories I've seen, how many people have walked over to me and told me their child is alive today because of the training.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin needs more housing, but skyrocketing construction costs have made it hard to build homes the average family can afford. Wisconsin Habitat for Humanity affiliates are working to fix that. Addie Costello reports on the nonprofit's changing model.
On a spring afternoon, Kaya Fox maneuvers around mounds of dirt surrounding 4 new homes in southwestern Wisconsin. She climbs a set of makeshift stairs that lead to a tarped wall and front door. The outside of the homes need work, Fox says, but on the inside?
We've got a really beautiful backsplash all around. We've got really beautiful higher-end appliances and range hoods.
Fox is the executive director of Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse region. She walks through one of the nonprofit's latest developments. The 3 bedrooms have new carpet, there's a walk-in closet. And the bathrooms have
the soft clothes drawers, like a boom.
But only one detail on the inside of the house reveals how it got there. A missing strip of drywall between the kitchen and living room shows 2 walls pressed together. That's because a Minnesota factory shipped the constructed home on 2 semi-trucks.
There's really nothing that we need to do other than, you know, put the 2 pieces together, hang up some trim, and then these houses are complete.
That means volunteers really only need to help with the home's garages and landscaping. Fox says that's a major change for the decades-old organization.
The quintessential putting the walls up with volunteers has kind of been since forever how Habitat does things.
But even with volunteer labor, building a home on site has gotten significantly more expensive in recent years. As the country started facing a severe housing shortage, affiliates like Fox's were forced to build fewer homes.
You know, we can't get drywall any cheaper, but can we look at solutions that A, not only get us housing at a cheaper price, but much quicker to address a need that is here?
A nonprofit research organization found that in 2021, the average site-built house cost twice as much per square foot than a manufactured home. That's why Habitat La Crosse started using mostly factory-built homes in new developments, and similar groups nationwide are following suit. But Fox's group has faced barriers to replicating the Hillsborough development. Amy Bliss is the executive director of the Wisconsin Housing Alliance. It's a manufactured housing trade association.
The frustrating thing is that people want affordable housing, but they want it in the next town over. They don't want it in their town.
She says lingering stigma from early 1970s mobile homes have led to local zoning and deed restrictions that prohibit manufactured housing. But Bliss says modern manufactured homes can look and appreciate in value similar to site-built houses. That became clear to Katie and Russell Bessel as soon as they saw one of the homes this summer.
Beautiful countertops, cabinets, flooring, like it's gorgeous.
Very gorgeous.
The La Crosse-based Habitat affiliate chose the Bessels for one of 10 factory-built homes they are placing in Hillsborough. The new house will have a yard for their three children. It will also be accessible for Russell, who is paralyzed from the waist down. Right now, he struggles to maneuver his wheelchair around their scrunched apartment. Every night, he watches his family eat dinner from his bed in the living room.
I'm tired of that. I want to sit down and have a family meal.
In their new house?
There will be an island in the kitchen to where I can roll underneath and just raise my chair up and eat dinner with my family.
Habitat for Humanity will provide the couple borrowing assistance to keep their monthly mortgage payment affordable based on their income. For the Bessels, it doesn't matter how the home was built. They've spent the last several years bouncing around the state to find reliable housing.
This is the end of the road for us. Like, this is finally ours.
While the Bessels' future home won't be built or shipped until the new year, they're already planning to host Christmas in 2026. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. In Wisconsin rose by 15% between 2014 and 2023. That's according to a new report by Prevent Suicide Wisconsin. But organizations across the state are working to prevent suicides by training individuals and teams of people in healthcare and social service settings and in other community spaces. Now we visit two community efforts to get suicides in Wisconsin down to zero. Nicole Winkus is Behavioral Health Manager at Green Lake County Health and Human Services, and Levy Stein is President and CEO of the Friendship Circle of Wisconsin. They talked with Rob Ferret on Friday.
Well, we've seen some of the latest statistics from Prevent Suicide Wisconsin, their latest numbers in 2023. We're seeing a gradual increase in the suicide rate in the state over about a nine-year period. As you talk to people, as you work with people and do trainings, Levy, let's start with you. Are you seeing a growing concern and maybe a growing interest in preventing suicide?
I think we see both of that at the same time, which is good and bad. Today's day and age, with technology growing, with things moving so quickly, especially around social media for our younger population, the trends, both good and bad, are happening at the same time. We need to keep up, we need to catch up, and we need to spread awareness.
And Nicole, what are you hearing in your community?
Similarly, we've seen an increase in contacts to our mental health crisis line and calls for suicide risk assessment. We've seen an increase in need for outpatient services. And along with that, we've really seen an increase in community awareness and just, you know, members of the community who want to be a part of the conversation and want to talk and learn about these issues, which is just such an important part of doing the work.
And for both of you, I understand work on these issues isn't just a job or something like that for you. You both have had, sadly, personal experiences that inspired some of the work you do. Nicole, can you talk a little bit about what's inspired you to go into behavioral health and suicide prevention?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was in high school, I lost a close friend of mine to suicide, which, you know, there were many precipitating factors and mental health was among those. But really just being a part of that community of young people who was impacted by that loss and seeing how kind of the ripple effect and how widespread that was. And I think probably helped shape many of us to go in a direction to try to help people. And that's how I found the field of psychology. And that's how I found the work I do today.
And Levy, your inspiration.
There's so many different points of inspiration, but I would say two points that really stand out. One is this goes back about 20 something years ago when I lost a really, really good friend to suicide, someone who I thought I knew and thought I understood. And, you know, we were good friends. And one day to just have that taken away from you really brought so many questions to me. But what I would say is exactly a year ago, pretty much to the day, November 3rd of last year, I lost a dear friend, Alderman Brostoff, to suicide. And that's what really, you know, took this work to a whole new level. Up until this point, we were struggling with funding. We were waiting around, waiting for the right places to host these programs. And when he died, I really got fed up and I said, we're done waiting around. People are dying and we need to do something now. And that's when we started the We Can Save Lives tour and really pushing suicide prevention training to get out all over southeastern Wisconsin and beyond to train as many people as possible to prepare them and to really save lives.
And Levy, take us into this We Can Save Lives tour and this barnstorming tour of suicide prevention. What are you training people on? What are they learning when they go to one of your sessions?
So there are many different types of trainings that are out there. There's shorter trainings like QPR. There's longer trainings like ASSIST, which is a two-day training. The training I advocate for the most is Safe Talk, which is a four-hour training. So it's somewhat of a balance. We spend a lot of time talking about what to look out for. What are those, what we call invitations or signs that someone might be struggling with thoughts of suicide? Then we talk about how to ask the question. There are so many right and wrong ways. I think the most important lesson from that section is don't be too afraid that you're asking it wrong. It's more important to ask it than not to ask it, but still talking about the right way to do it, how to ask directly about suicide. And then how to be a good listener, and most importantly, how to connect them to help. If you don't connect people to help, then again, you don't know if they're in a safe place. So making that connection, making that introduction to professional support is a critical piece of the training. And we go into detail. We practice, we role play. We have, you know, time for Q&A. We role play again. And until we really, really instill the right behaviors and the right process to help someone stay safe.
And Nicole, in Green Lake, you're working with a program called Zero Suicide Wisconsin. In practice, what does that look like?
Zero Suicide is really a continuous quality improvement process. And so in practice, what that has been for us is really about expanding who we think of as being in a role to help prevent suicide. And so, you know, for a lot of people, suicide is a really scary topic when they start talking about it. And many people initially think right away of mental health professionals, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and those types of supports, I think, are so important. And it's not enough because we've really looked at our data and we found that many people who are at heightened risk for suicide that are coming into contact with our crisis services have not been in mental health services previously. The people that they're really opening up to and talking to are in all kinds of other positions. So what we're doing is we're looking across the workforce and we're surveying people about their experiences and we're engaging and finding how can we connect people who are really in any position to be talking to people, even outside of their professional lives, that want to learn and connecting them to trainings such as QPR and many of the other models that Levy mentioned.
We're talking about suicide prevention training and education with Nicole Winkes, a behavioral health manager at Green Lake County Health and Human Services, and Levy Stein, Friendship Circle of Wisconsin, president and CEO. Levy, you talked about the right ways and wrong ways to ask that question. And again, to hammer home that point, it's better to ask that question than to get caught up maybe in the best way to ask it. But for that person who says, gosh, this loved one or a coworker, whoever, I'm worried about them. I'm worried they're thinking potentially about suicide. How can someone broach that conversation? What are the best ways?
So in general, you don't have to start the conversation with the question. You don't call them up and you say, hi, friend, are you thinking of suicide, right? You want to be there for them. You want to have a conversation. And in that conversation, you're going to be talking about different things that you noticed, right? You're going to be saying that you haven't been going to work lately. I noticed you're kind of organizing your affairs. Why are you doing that? And generate conversation. And then at some point, you're going to say, people who generally do those things might be thinking about suicide. Are you thinking about suicide? And again, it's important to get right to the point during that conversation and ask the question directly. If you just say, you know, are you okay? Or, you know, you can always talk to me. Those are very fine and wonderful things to say, but you're not going to get the answer that you need. Because if the person answers yes, or maybe, or kind of, or sometimes, you're going to have a very different reaction than if you don't know the answer to the question.
Nicole, in your trainings there, you mentioned working with professionals a lot. Are you also looking to get the word out to, you know, peers and family members and loved ones to be able to open those conversations Levy was talking about?
Yes, absolutely. I think at its heart, the zero suicide kind of movement is really about empowering people to have those discussions and really to feel comfortable listening and hearing the responses when they do start to talk to anybody, whether it's their loved one or a, you know, a client that they're trying to support, or even a complete stranger who just happens to be in front of them and is showing signs that they are not doing well.
I'm going to ask each of you about your particular region. I imagine there might be a different challenge between an urban area and rural. And Nicole, let's start with you. Green Lake, more of a rural county. Does that raise particular challenges or maybe even particular opportunities when it comes to suicide prevention?
You know, I think it can be both at times, challenging, and there's some added opportunities in a smaller area. You know, we have a fantastic team. Being in a small community, we've really been able to connect on a personal level with leadership across a variety of sectors. So we're really fortunate here in Green Lake to have the support of people who you maybe wouldn't normally think of as being a part of a mental health effort. On the other hand, in Green Lake here, we can be kind of isolated from resources that maybe it, you know, is, it's just a further drive, or it can be more difficult for somebody to get to that help once it's identified that they need it. And so sometimes, you know, that can create challenges once somebody has broached that subject and has brought up that they are thinking about suicide. Then that step of then connecting to them to professional help can have some added barriers that people really need to be prepared to help somebody try to work through.
And Levy, as you mentioned, you work in Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin, mostly a more urban area. Again, unique challenges or maybe unique opportunities you might have in that environment.
I think there's different challenges in different places. I've traveled the state. I've been both, you know, all over Milwaukee as well as more rural areas. In those areas, I would go to the fire department. Okay, sometimes they're small volunteer fire departments, and they are the resources for those communities because there aren't mental health resources in the immediate area. So sometimes you need to seek out those support levels as well. With the, you know, big cities, sometimes people are overwhelmed. They don't know where to go because they don't know what resource helps what, and they're afraid. You know, for some people, going to the children's hospital mental health walk-in clinic can be intimidating. And they're afraid of that big, you know, big building. And for other places, it's easier to walk into. So it really depends. Each city presents different challenges. What's beautiful about these trainings is we can take them anywhere. The QPR training, you could even do online. The Safe Talk training, we could bring it to your community. All we need is 10 people in a room, and you can bring the training to you.
Nicole, in working with people and communities there in Green Lake County, do you see that stigma where people don't want to talk about suicide, or are you seeing change over time?
Both. I think that we do see the stigma there, and we see people really rising to the occasion and finding that people want to talk about these things and want to learn more. Sometimes they don't feel that they have the tools or the skills to do that, and that's where these types of community trainings that really can reach members of the public at all levels are so important for people to participate in. I think, along with that stigma, there's also sometimes a fear that we hear that if you ask somebody directly about suicide, that is going to somehow increase their risk. And that is, I think, one of the bigger myths that's out there about suicide that can unfortunately get in the way of people having those conversations.
And Levy, I'll give you the last word. Can you give some encouragement to somebody listening right now to try to organize a session, whether through you or a local resource like Nicole's?
Well, first of all, we're working together, right? We're not going to stop doing this until there are zero suicides. And I encourage everyone to bring a training to you. Right now, we're subsidizing the cost to take away that barrier so anyone in the state of Wisconsin could bring a training to them. And I can't tell you how many stories I've seen, how many people have walked over to me and told me their child is alive today because of the training. So everyone out there listening should absolutely take a training, be kind to one another, and let's continue fighting this until there are indeed zero suicides in Wisconsin.
I'll leave it there. Levy, thanks for joining us.
It was an honor to be here today.
And Nicole, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Levy Stein leads Friendship Circle of Wisconsin. Nicole Winkus is Behavioral Health Manager in Green Lake County. They spoke with Rob Ferret. Coming up, a rock and roll multimedia history show tells the stories of Wisconsinites whose lives were changed by World War I.
The mission of Mobilize the Poets is to celebrate everyday people who have lived through extraordinary times.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This Veterans Day, a troupe of musicians, historians, and theater artists in Wisconsin will put on a multimedia rock and roll history show about Wisconsin and World War I. The group Mobilize the Poets was created to honor the lives of everyday people who have lived through extraordinary times. Their first show is called The Foe and the Fallen, Stories from the Greatest War. It will play at the Barrymore Theater in Madison on November 11th, and they're hoping to tour the show around the state in the near future. Here's a taste of one of the songs, Ken Fitzsimmons in the WPR studio performing She Works on Cars, about women working at jobs vacated by men called up for service in the war.
And she'll take your cash, give a ticket in a flash, send a telegram home. She'll operate the phone, get up early with the cows, grind the metal for the plows, load the cargo on the boat, but she doesn't get to vote. Do you think he sees her there? Do you think he is aware? Do you think he noticed if she's gone?
Ken Fitzsimmons is a co-founder of the Irish rock group The Kissers. He's also founder, writer, and performer with Mobilize the Poets. And Jason Fassel is a lighting designer with his company Anti-Shadows Theatrical Design. He does design, lighting, and production management for the project. And they spoke last week with Rob Ferret.
You created, Ken, Mobilize the Poets to put on rock and roll history shows in Wisconsin, starting in Madison, maybe more to come. Give us a sense of the origins of this idea.
So it all started in 2018 when we put on a show called The Greatest War. World War I, Wisconsin, and why it still matters. A couple of my friends, John Wedge and Sean Michael Dargan, along with Jason Fassel, we put together this rock and roll history show to commemorate the 100th anniversary of World War I. And it was music and imagery and reading of quotes.
And you're telling stories in This Is the Foe and the Fallen. I've talked to you about this when it came out as an album. What kind of stories are you telling about Wisconsinites who were in the Great War, in World War I?
Well, in The Foe and the Fallen, so what this this show is a it's the Kissers portion of The Greatest War. So, of course, as we talked, we recorded the album, and we then put this back into the rock and roll history format. So we will tell stories about Wisconsinites who served in the war, who worked, and who resisted.
And Jason, this is, you know, there's a band up here playing, but there's more than that. There's a strong visual production element. Tell us about your vision for this project and what we'll see if we go to the show.
Yeah, we conceived the piece to be a visual spectacle, like a rock show, but with a historical element. So instead of just, you know, stock rock and roll footage behind a rock band, you know, we're doing, Ken has all this historic society imagery that we are putting behind the band, and we're timing out many of the lighting cues with the visuals of the projections and the slides, and some of the you'll see a name scroll of everyone who passed in from Wisconsin in World War I. And as that scrolls across the screen, the lighting will do a motion very similar and complement that motion in a vertical fashion, or sometimes in a horizontal fashion. But yeah.
So Ken, what is it about this live show format that lends itself to history? Because we read a lot of history, or I do anyway, and there are history documentaries. What is it about this format that you love to tell these stories of Wisconsin?
Well, that's a great question, because I see it as a retelling, maybe a reimagining in a sense of how we can experience the stories of the past, also known as history. And what it is it hits you in different ways, right? As Jason was saying, we have this visual sense, literally seeing these images towering over the band of people who lived 100 years ago. Then you have, of course, the music, which has the ability to, you know, bypass your brain, right, and speak directly to your heart and to your soul. And that immersive experience combined with a focus on connecting with people. I like to say I'm not trying to even teach history. I'm just trying to build connection. And that connection can be across time. You can feel connected to somebody who lived 100 years ago. And so it's a new way of experiencing history or people's stories.
Right. And Ken, yeah, I think about this. You know, you could read a book about World War I and how the politics broke down and the leaders tried to rush into war or avoid it. You are really trying to bridge that human story and help people feel like what it would have been like for a Wisconsinite, say, to deploy to France. Why is that such an important part of understanding history for you?
Well, that's a great point. And so the mission of Mobilize the Poets is to celebrate everyday people who have lived through extraordinary times, right? And that's something that we can certainly relate to now, but can relate to in many times. And so for me, learning this history is healing. When I see that others have struggled or stepped up and done something extraordinary, I feel less alone in my own world and in my own struggles, realizing that I share it with people across time.
And Jason, as you're putting together the visuals, as you mentioned, you've got this Wisconsin Historical Society and I think veterans material that Ken pulled together. And I imagine you had to spend a lot of time with these pictures and the stories attached to them. Did you feel connected to these people that you were ultimately putting on stage behind Ken and the band?
I think that the Wisconsin connection is what makes this piece so special and what really connects us to our audience and what our story with Mobilize the Poets is all about. The human connection and the Wisconsin connection, I think, is very important to our audience and to our story.
And Ken, I keep meaning to ask, where did this name Mobilize the Poets come from?
So I've been working on another show that comes after The Foe and the Fallen about the year 1919. And while working on that, I learned about the independence of Ireland, which gets declared in January of 1919, and the interim president of Ireland at that time is in jail as a political prisoner because they're a rebel government. And while he's there, he sends a memo to the other members of the Irish Dáil, the Irish Parliament, and he tells them to go to France, where the peace conference is happening, and talk to everyone you can to recognize the sovereignty of Ireland. And he lists all these specific things, talk to these senators, talk to these diplomats, and then further down he says, mobilize the poets. Perhaps Yeats can use his muse for Ireland now.
We're talking to Ken Fitzsimmons, founder, writer, and performer with Mobilize the Poets. He created to put on rock and roll history shows here in Wisconsin. And his partner on this, Jason Fassel of Anti-Shadows Theatrical Design. He does the design, lighting, and production management for Mobilize the Poets. Jason, I understand you and Ken have known each other for a good long time now, started working together on projects as early as 8th grade. What did that look like? What kind of shows were you two putting on then?
Yeah, I had heard Ken, I'd known Ken from in junior high, and Ken was forming a rock band, and I wanted nothing more than to be a part of a rock band. And I am a fairly horrible percussionist, drummer, and I asked if I could be the drummer, and Ken said, oh my God, oh no, we have Jamie. We have Jamie Ryan playing drums. And I was like, oh, Jamie's the best in the whole world. So Ken, what can I do to help out? And so that was my transition into becoming a theater technician. And I have stayed in that career path ever since. I have been doing technical theater from that point forward. At that time, I learned how to set up the audio rig and mix audio. And, you know, my dad and I built some switch boxes for lights and running orange extension cords for lights many, many decades ago. And Ken and I have been doing, I've been lighting Ken ever since. So it's been 30 some years of lighting, almost 40 years, I guess, of lighting Ken on stages around the state.
Ken, this is more ambitious than my junior high band was, for sure. I'm glad the internet wasn't around then. But did having Jason and this visual element to your shows shape how you thought about performances and what a band could do beyond we're on a stage? You know, maybe we could be on a stage and having this incredible visual story of World War One history.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a musician, I've always kind of been a playing musician, meaning like, you know, give me the songs, give me the part, I'm going to play it. And thought less as a songwriter, even though I've written songs for a long time. And instead of a show being just a set of tunes, you know, which is fun to do. Like, you can be on stage and like, oh, let's call this tune, let's go. This is a show from beginning to end. And that is what Jason has really helped me with, you know, and that's that combining of the at least for me, it's combining of the theater world with the music world, that we're going to put on a performance. And from the moment we hit that stage, the moment we're done is one full experience.
Jason, it's one thing to light a middle school band. Your storytelling in this show, in The Foe and the Fallen here, how did you work with the band to coordinate the visuals, the images, and the way you tell that visual side of the story in this performance?
Yeah, each song has its own color palette and its own tempo and its own feel, and I use that those emotional responses that I get from listening to the songs to create the visuals. And then I accentuate the dramatics and the dynamics of the song as we pass through the song. And then I try to work with Ken to make sure that the whole evening has an arc and that the beginning relates to the end and that we work from a beginning point to an ending point through each song, but also through the entire evening.
Now, Ken, we've got the performance coming on Veterans Day, of course, and you're hoping, this isn't locked down yet, you're hoping to take this on the road and perform elsewhere in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is this show on November 11th is a launching of Mobilize the Poets as this new arts organization, and it's equally a launching of The Foe and the Fallen. This is our premiere of this redux show of The Greatest War. And then our next step is to travel it around Wisconsin and the Midwest.
And staying with the future now, you've got a sequel planned already. After the war, you mentioned 1919. Well, a lot of stories to tell. There are people coming back home from Europe and the war, the influenza outbreak, economic dislocation and disruption. How are you going to narrow it down? What kind of stories are you looking to tell there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if you don't mind, I'm going to back up just for a second.
Sure.
Because I wanted to share a little bit more about the foundation of Mobilize the Poets, because it's kind of wrapped up in that show, which is, you know, I had a big life experience when my father passed away in 2020. And he and I were very close. And after that happened, I had this, you know, moment of what do I want to do with the rest of my precious time here on Earth? And as I looked back at The Greatest War and saw the huge impact on people, I realized this is work I wanted to continue. And so we actually discussed, Sean and John and I discussed, and Jason, a little bit what the next thing might be. And we tossed some ideas around but didn't really settle on anything together. And that's when I landed on 1919. And I read a book about it called Savage Peace by Anne Hagedorn. And yes, what you just said is the more I read, the more I was sort of my jaw was kind of just hanging open as I read about it. So just an example of a few things that happened in 1919. There are mass deportations without due process, what will be later called the Palmer Raids. There's a huge fight for women's rights as they're fighting for the right to vote. And other rights. There are a number of race riots that year when African-American soldiers come home and have just been trained to fight and now are no longer going to violent actions happen against them, they start fighting back. And this is all happening after a global pandemic.
So you're saying it sounds familiar or some familiar themes in some ways?
So what I do is just sort of say the things as they happen and let the audience decide whether or not those themes seem familiar.
Jason, you've worked with American Players Theater and other groups. The mission of Mobilize the Poets, what has that meant to you? What do you take away from the wider goal that Ken's been talking about here?
I think my whole career is about storytelling and experiencing, having our audiences experience other stories. And as Ken just said with 1919 Project, how the themes are relative from 100 years ago to today. And I think the empathy and the exposure to those stories throughout time are what we do in theater and what the plan and the scope of Mobilize the Poets is to reach a greater audience with these stories.
And we'll leave it there. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ken, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much, Rob.
Ken Fitzsimmons and Jason Fassel are with the group Mobilize the Poets, and they spoke with Rob Ferret. The ongoing government shutdown has raised a lot of questions about SNAP benefits and how families are able to get food on the table. And we want to know what questions you have, what you want clarity on, or perhaps you have a story in your community to help illuminate what this government shutdown means to people here in Wisconsin. Reach out to us with your questions or information you want us to track down to cut through some of the confusion and worry. And you can also share your story about the government shutdown. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch with us. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. And thank you for helping us to deepen our reporting in this moment. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Royce Padeswa, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.